Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
One of the fantastic opportunities that Zoom provides us with, as we know, as we've gone to San Diego, as we've gone to Los Angeles, as we've opened up a whole range of things, we now actually sort of move to the joyous, wonderful land of the University of East Anglia, where we're delighted to actually welcome back to the Midweek Drive one of, in many ways, the arguably the founder members of the whole system, currently professor in media practice at the School of Art, Media and American Studies at the University of East Anglia, formerly professor of theatre and media drama at the University of South Wales, founding co-editor of the Journal of Adaptation in Film and Performance, and of course a senior fellow of the Higher Education Academy. It is the one and only Professor Richard Hand. Welcome back to the Midweek Drive, Richard. How are you?
Hi, Alex. It's lovely to be back.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, it's something I don't think any of us had kind of anticipated. I mean, I was a very reluctant convert to certainly Skype, and I never really rated Skype, to be honest. I don't care if the Microsoft people are listening. I always thought that was a bit clunky. It was difficult.
Yeah.
But I have become a Zoom follower, although it has to be said, I'm of the generation that actually used to refer to Zoom as an iced lolly in the 1960s with lots of sprinkles and things.
Now you're talking.
Exactly. You know, and yet somehow the computer doesn't work when you actually stick a lolly into it. Although, you know, these days, you know, who knows what could actually happen.
Yeah.
At the University of Lincoln, obviously, like all higher educational services, we've been going through some interesting times over the last year. Share with us at the University of East Anglia, from your own point of view, in terms of drama and performance, how that's been going, because I know from our colleagues in San Diego State University and in California and so on, they've been missing certainly the face-to-face contact and the necessity of actually having that for drama, even though obviously specialising in radio drama, I tend to sort of think it's what we've been waiting for, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're all desperately missing face-to-face. We've done some tentative steps towards that. And once you get used to that alienating situation where you've got a large auditorium with 10 people in it, you know, you kind of get used to it. So, yeah, but I mean, some things have worked very well, actually, with being online. And as you say, Alex, radio drama and, you know, some of the work I do for the Edgar Allan Poe Theatre Project has carried on unabated. You know, because radio is a great form for pandemics, you know, think of all those wonderful science fiction films where there is a dystopian apocalypse and there's the voice crackling on the radio. There is life.
We were made for it, he says, as he wears his Zoom mask. But thankfully, actually, I realise I don't actually have to wear the mask when delivering it. That, again, was one of the interesting things where I refer to it as not face-to-face teaching, but face-to-visor teaching or face-to-mask teaching.
Exactly, yeah.
Rather like the University of Lincoln, part of the last academic year, you might have had those dreadful words. Well, I say dreadful words. They tend to sort of bring many academics out in cold sweats. Blended learning.
Yes, exactly. We hear it a lot, don't we? And guess what? That's what we're planning next year as well.
Exactly. I mean, it is something where, and I've spoken to students who've had their colleagues or their children have actually gone to the Open University, and they've said that actually universities like Lincoln, and I think the University of East Anglia as well, have actually provided a much better opportunity because we are much more contactable rather than actually taking the view that, yes, I've cited them, so I'll cite them again, the Open University have, which is, well, it's all online. Go on, deal with it. It's there, basically. I think we have kind of gone over and above that line, probably because, obviously, in both our cases, Richard, we go back to the days of the University of Humberside, where we just slogged on regardless.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the other thing is we found some modules have worked quite well. This year we've got a module on documentary, and normally the students kind of work in the film archive we have here. They work in a team and they produce a 25-minute documentary, etc. We realised we couldn't work like that, so they had to make solo films, 5-minute films. They were given a kind of catalogue of stuff from the film archive, which they could access online. And we were very worried, thinking this isn't going to be like it used to be. And it wasn't. In some ways, it was better. They could produce some beautiful short films, including some just using an iPhone and recording in their rooms or whatever. But some also walking on around sort of deserted cityscapes. And I mean, they were extraordinary pieces. So we were very, very pleased with the final results. So actually, it was one that, weirdly, it was fine in the end in this new situation.
It is quite interesting, because I know we spoke at length with Louis Savvy, who's the founder of the Sci-Fi London Film Festival. And Louis actually introduced a thing called the 48-hour film challenge about 6 or 7 years ago, actually, which some Lincoln students actually went in for. And indeed, one group, because they weren't able to actually work together, they actually produced an apocalyptic take back in 2018 via their mobile phones. Clearly ahead of the game, ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And the thing that also struck me is, given your own interest in Grand Guignol Theatre and going back to those experiences, the kind of experience that we've all gone through with respect to the fear, with respect to the uncertainty, with respect to the notion of, well, we're doomed, we're going for herd immunity, it's the Great Reset, it's all part of Bill Gates' grand plan to take over everything. So many kind of tropes coming through that. I mean, if we projected ahead to, shall we say, the year 21, I think we can actually sort of see people maybe looking back at this time and saying, how did they honestly cope with that? Because let's face it, if the pandemic had hit back at the start of the century, there's absolutely no way we would have actually been able to deliver 1/10 of what we've been able to do, because the technology, and this is obviously a conspiracy theorist stream, yes, interesting, the technology just came about at the right time when we needed it.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. It really has occurred to me a lot as well, yeah.
Well, I was thinking particularly, I think you did one study a few years ago, which dealt with the notion of online dating and sort of the twists and the tales that were working through that. And I'm sure that there are creatives who, I mean, we're already seeing it, the kind of the Amazon Prime series of Solos. I don't know if you've seen any of those features with the likes of Helen.
I haven't yet. No, that's right. I mean, I've really enjoyed some of the new releases on Netflix, like The Woman in the Window and Run. And these are wonderful kind of lockdown narratives. And I know in some cases that a lot of the filming was done before the pandemic, but they have an added weight. And yes, they're sort of Hitchcock's Rear Window, but blimey, they are lockdown narratives as well.
It's interesting. You mentioned the Amy Adams, not quite classic take on Hitchcock with Woman in the Window. Yeah. And of course, what a cast. I mean, you've got Julianne Moore in there as well. You've got Gary Oldman. Certainly our film critic team didn't quite rate it as highly. They felt it was a bit clumsy in certain ways, that they sort of didn't connect in a number of sort of aspects. I thought it was fair. It was a brave attempt. Probably too much use of the F-bomb. I mean, what is it with adult movies these days? Hitchcock never used to drop the F-bomb in, or the equivalent of sort of cussing in the whole system. But yeah, other than that, it is interesting. And you're right, obviously, we take it up another level and we look at Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, and you've got another case in point where it's the entire aspect of Las Vegas, which is walled off. I wonder where they got that wall idea from. Other sort of areas, including, of course, spoiler alert, the nuclear bomb or nuclear bombing of Vegas that actually takes place as well. So intriguing how that works too. Back in the day, and I'm talking the start of the pandemic, March 23rd, the anniversary of lockdown 2020, I think I signed off the last studio piece from Siren Radio with indeed the definition of a scientist from the Charlton Heston Omega Man classic. Definition of a scientist, somebody who understood nothing until there was nothing left to understand. Interesting. But of course, Contagion, we've talked about the Omega Man, all of those sort of things, survivors, I think that will have undergone a huge burst of a flu-like vaccine that sort of impacted on life and various other things. And of course, really, it's only, I suppose, the Spanish flu that people actually had, not necessarily in living memory, although I think there were one or two survivors who were sort of still around who could just about hear that. But of course, back in the 20th century, with, of course, the Great War, there were other things governments had on their mind rather than saying, yeah, let's look after the population, or best not panic them. After all, we've got to beat the Germans, so let's carry on.
I think that was one of the best things. I watched The Strain, finally, got round to watching that. And that's one of the best things in that, is the kind of political ructions, you know, the the district of New York City responding differently to the surrounding areas and, you know, haggling about their border, really, again, has a sort of resonance now for sure.
You must join us on Resonance Rewind, a show which we developed just out of Zoom, in which we cast our collective mind with a mixture of professional writers and actors and students, of course, over classic and indeed much often maligned episodes of TV series in the past. We recently looked at comparison between the original Nightmare at 20,000 Feet episode of The Twilight Zone with William Shatner and, of course, Jordan Peele's incarnation of Nightmare at 30,000 Feet, yeah. Which I think many people say isn't a patch on the original, apart from the appearance of the gremlin that actually emerges in the backdrop. But of course, Jordan Peele, in so many ways, very much in the footsteps of the legacy of Rod Serling in terms of actually writing things through. And what better time actually for The Twilight Zone to reemerge in its own right in the sort of thing where, if you do like the classic, ooh, there he's appearing now. You've got that whole sort of sequence that kind of, again, shows that descent into madness and insanity and healthcare and all of the other areas within that.
That's right. Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed those. It's been wonderful to see those come back. And in fact, it's been a great era for that kind of dark fantasy TV, hasn't it? With Them, which is an extraordinary series, but not for the faint-hearted. I must admit, even myself, sometimes watch the 50-minute episode in three goes. but there's that. And you know, and other things have just been a real treat, a real delight, I'd say.
We're following this interview with a couple of features on technology in the everyday life of SMEs, etc., and a big push in fact, via one of our colleagues at the Open University who's sort of arguing about how we need to get more involved with technology and be trained. Now, I think we kind of share this notion as being, so the Higher Education Academy, of course, and the whole aspect of there's a difference philosophically between training and education. And sometimes people mistake that. They say, we just want you to train you to actually use. It's like being a footballer. You train and train, or Olympic athlete, etc. You train for the whole thing, or an actor. But there's also that notion of actually choreographing your own steps or leading out that inner potential. I've seen, as I'm sure, I mean, you've already alluded to, students who've really risen to the challenge. And we've also had students who have found it very difficult, very difficult to pursue, etc. Because, again, there is this state, this sort of acceptance that, well, everybody's got broadband. Everybody can actually do this. No, I didn't have broadband myself. I came out of lockdown, in fact, or came into lockdown, diddly squat, basically, having to go on a massive learning curve. Because if I share with you, and you might sort of drop, your jaw might drop with shock at this moment, but the University of Lincoln, for staff such as myself, and indeed many other colleagues, etc., we had our machines in the office, but the machines had no cameras and no microphones. So go figure how we can then actually engage in a situation where you're basically having to type very quickly in a chat box. Other than that, there's no connectivity whatsoever.
Wow.
I know. This is our Vietnam. You know, what did you do in the war, Daddy? We sat at home and we stayed at home and we sought out our broadband. I know everything's relative. But my point, basically, Richard, is that there are lots of students who would have been in exactly the same position. And I think that's one of the, I mean, we talked about a fail-safe and a sort of backup mechanism, etc. But even as we head into a world which may never actually return to full face-to-face contact again, I mean, I think there are issues and lots of philosophical debates in terms of where we, you know, how efficient is it to deliver lectures online and various other things. And yeah, certainly from the student's perspective, I'm sure you might have had the instance yourself where students have said, no, I can't switch my camera on because I'm actually in bed at present. It's okay.
Yeah.
why would you actually have the hassle of getting out of bed, getting the clothes on, going to campus, you're getting all the rest of it? I mean, what a hassle, you know. How tiresome for that whole thing. You know? So many things you can actually work through. I have to say, I have never delivered a single lecture yet in my pajamas, and I do not intend to do so unless there's a significant salary hike actually at the end of it. So But there is that sense where I know colleagues certainly have said that it's difficult when you have just a whole series of blank faces and you do the line of putting something out there and say, anybody got any comments? I mean, it's very much, and this is again, a tale which I think is waiting to be written, the equivalent of saying, Zoom, a kind of 21st century seance. Is there anybody there? Is there anybody there? In terms of the process, I mean, we've looked at the positive sides, we've looked at the negative sides, etc. Do you feel as though we're coming out? I mean, I say we're coming out of it. Who knows? I mean, you know, in a world in which basically, given the delivery and the vitriol of Mr. Cummings, which I thought, well, that might have actually had an impact, etc. No, because of course then BJ gets married to Princess Carrie and all's well with the world because it's a royal wedding. It's fantastic. So given that line, in which I'm sure Gavin Williamson will have actually sort of said, yeah, I'm really on the side of all academics on this side of things. Do you feel that the glass is half full or half empty, or is it a case of it's the same as it's ever been, except at this time we have different technologies to express our work?
I think, I don't know, I feel we're in a balance at the moment because we need a bigger uptake of the vaccine, because I think that will make a huge difference and people don't quite realise that. And we need a well world, I think. And, you know, there's some countries that are desperate for any vaccine at all. But, you know, I've encountered anti-vax people who surprised me that their attitude has been that. So, you know, I don't know. And, you know, we've really got to build up that uptake in order to protect us, and that will help us move forward, I think.
Personally, on a day where I just thought, coming to the end now, I've just completed the 39th essay, 3,000 word essay, it's now been completed, it's all marked, etc. Just got three more extensions before I've wrapped up all 42 of the science fiction essays from that. And then literally on that moment when I'm just thinking of going on the beach, we're getting this whole side of a colleague who basically says, oh, can you just second mark these 12 advanced research methods aspects for me by next week, if that's possible, please. They're only 2,000 words apiece, and they're only sort of, you know, whatever. Yeah, we'll go with that. So we carry on regardless. That's the important thing. Yeah. Richard, how can people access your fabulous online radio material and indeed access that as well? What's the best way to find you on the web?
The best way, if people look up the National Edgar Allan Poe Theatre on the Air, they can find it various ways. The podcast is on Spotify, it's on Amazon, it's various places you can find that. But you can also find it through NPR, National Public Radio in the States. So it's all there as well. And we're about to start a very exciting project in the UK, but working with the Poe team and the wonderful Cesar, who's a composer based in China, who does wonderful soundscapes.
That's where it all started, Richard. Is that safe?
Yeah, I know. So we'll be doing that, and then that will be on BBC Upload. So we're very excited about that. So that should be there in October. But yeah, it's if you start looking for it, you can't miss it. So National Edgar Allan Poe is on the air.
And as indeed I shared with several of my students this year, that if we're looking at the foreshadowing authors of science fiction, if we take Mary Shelley as being one of the prime progenitors of the science fiction we appreciate today, as Brian Alder said, if you want to actually start off a consideration of when science fiction started, maybe 1815, Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus with Shelley is a good place to start. You've got Wells. But let's not forget that actually, if you're talking about detective fiction, horror fiction, science fiction, Edgar Allan Poe was very much at the forefront of actually producing that with respect to the state. A lot of people get surprised when we mention the fact Edgar Allan Poe, science fiction writer, etc. But actually, there are a number of his texts, which again, you're much more capable of actually working through, which did have that science fiction grounding in there as well.
That's right, absolutely. And as you say, detective fiction as well. I mean, he was an extraordinary writer, and it's been enormous fun adapting his works. And we found, you know, that there's such a richness and such potential with his stuff, because you know, it's often been said he was the first radio writer. Now, he may have died in 1840.
Marconi was around later.
But he was all about sound. He was all about that sort of the unnerving power of the sonic. And, you know, and that again and again, you know, the telltale heart, the black cat. These are sonic monstrosities.
And of course, Hugo Gernsback, when he started producing Astounding Tales and his science fiction retreats, his reprints encompassed Edgar Rice Burroughs, Edgar Allan Poe, H.G. Wells, Jules Verne. They very much served as that foreshadowing of the likes of Heinlein, Asimov, Clarke, and of course, latterly, the likes of China Mieville, Ursula Le Guin, and Sherry S. Tepper, James Tiptree, and many others. Even Naomi Alderman, I think, probably has a debt to actually look back upon in terms of some of the writing of Edgar Allan Poe as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking of horror writers in terms of audio, it's been a very rich year for someone like H.P. Lovecraft. Now, he's a fascinating character.
The Call of Cthulhu. The Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah. But, you know, we had the wonderful Julian Simpson's radio versions of three of the stories on BBC Radio, and the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society produced an extraordinary one in lockdown conditions, fragmented audio pieces, which you kind of piece together as a listener. Yeah, and you know, there's been resonance there as well. It's been great.
Yeah, and it's also great to see a bit of a golden age with that former Jeff Bezos company. I mean, he's left it now to obviously deal with various other aspects, but certainly the opportunity to actually listen to X-1, some of the early radio productions and so on, and the ways in which they, I mean, we talked about The Twilight Zone, of course, they also prefigured in the 50s the kind of anthology aspects that actually emerged with The Twilight Zone, with The Outer Limits, with Night Gallery, with the whole range of things, including, let's be honest, Charlie Booker's Black Mirror. A lot of students love Black Mirror. They just love their Black Mirror. But sometimes looking at the sort of precursors of that, I think Charlie has a lot to sort of, again, have acknowledged in terms of Edgar Allan Poe, who launched the whole thing off as well.
Well, that's the opening of Black Mirror. Sometimes get my students to watch the opening sequence and then watch the opening sequence of The Outer Limits. And it's, you know, they can't deny it, Alex. They can't deny
exactly.
it.
Exactly. We have control of your television sets. We can control the vertical. We can change the focus and all of those sort of things. But that's brought us neatly round to the two questions which have been varied and have evolved, Richard. First of all, Professor Richard Hand, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer on the midweek drive today? Has it been okay for you?
Oh, it's been a delight, Alex.
Well, then the next critical question is, will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back and engage with some of our other students and souls? Will you come back in the very near future? Will you return?
I will. I will return. And we'll do something nice and uncanny with the students.
Shopping with a conscience, shopping with a social conscience, something which maybe is coming about as a result of the last 12 to 15 months that we've actually all been through, and indeed shopping with social purpose, with 56% of those surveyed in the recent year saying it's become more important from a business that gives back to society. We're delighted, therefore, to actually discuss this point with us, to welcome to the programme the head of social impact of eBay UK. That's the wonderful Chris Gale. How are you, Chris?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Excellent. So this particular finding or this particular survey, Chris, would you like to just talk us through some of the main headlines in terms of how shoppers are basically looking to change their habits and so on?
Yeah, so we released the report today to coincide with the launch of a program called eBay for Change. And I think what we can read into the findings is that, yes, we've seen a sort of gradual shift, and I think a significant shift over the last decade in terms of consumers thinking more about the impact that the businesses that they buy from have in the world, but that really has accelerated since the start of the pandemic. And another stat from it was two-thirds believe that businesses have an important role to play in tackling social and environmental challenges. And I think that's probably a significant step on where we would have been 18 months ago.
And one of the things, of course, that eBay is actually doing is working with Social Enterprise UK and the World Fair Trade Organization to actually bring another 50 social enterprises onto this online marketplace. I mean, clearly eBay has been a phenomenal success story globally. Is this a real opportunity to kind of ensure that you can actually connect that glocalization as opposed to globalization?
Yeah, so exactly. The program is called eBay for Change, and it's all about using the reach that we've got with the 29 million buyers that come through eBay UK every month, connecting them with social enterprises. So these are businesses that just like any other business, aim to make a profit, but it's what they do with those profits, reinvesting them into trying to deliver a particular social or environmental impact. And I think of the back to, you know, the stat I said before around business driving change in the world, I think social enterprises are the perfect example of businesses that are able to do that, and that they're a very reason for existence is to deliver that social or that environmental impact. And through the program, as you said, Alex, we're working with SE UK and the World Fair Trade Organization to bring their members onto eBay.co.uk with a dedicated hub that is all about supporting social enterprise. So when you go to the eBay for Change hub, you know that every business you buy from is exists to deliver on a particular social or environmental impact. And we're starting with 50 in this first round, but we certainly hope to grow that.
And what exactly do businesses actually need to do to actually become eligible for the eBay for Change system? Because I'm presuming that some of the multinational businesses out there that we hear a great deal about might sort of say, no, that's not for us.
Yeah, so at the moment, you need to be either a Social Enterprise UK member, and there's thousands of them around the UK, or a World Fair Trade Organization member. And that what that does is that guarantees that business has got within the articles that set them up, has a guarantee that they exist to deliver on that social or that environmental impact. So yes, they intend to make profit, but as I said, they guarantee that they reinvest that profit back into that particular impact. And we've got businesses like Change Please, which is a coffee business that was set up initially to support people experiencing homelessness, to train them up to be baristas, and now is expanding into selling coffee. We've got businesses like From Babies With Love, that is a baby clothing brand that donates 100% of its profits to supporting abandoned and orphaned children around the world. There's thousands of these businesses out there that are doing exactly that. And I think what's exciting is the diversity of these businesses and the diversity of the impact they're having.
It's really interesting that if we return back to the survey, that 92% of those who responded effectively said that since they had a child, or since they'd had basically had a new member of the family, they wanted to spend their cash with businesses who give back to society, and 74% wanted to spend or support more causes to help build a better future for the next generation. That's quite encouraging, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, I think I know after being a dad, I've got two young kids myself, things change. There's no question about that when you have those kids and you start to be aware of the impact that all of your consumption has on the world, because, you know, kids grow out of clothes pretty quickly. They grow out of toys pretty quickly. And so I have to say, I wasn't particularly surprised about that one. But I think what we're also seeing is that's a general trend. So I think, you know, as I said, over the last 10 years, this has grown, and maybe younger consumers are much more engaged particularly in where their money's going and the impact that the businesses that they buy from are having on the world. But I think what you're starting to see is that that's growing outside of, you know, millennials and Gen Z and moving into other groups as well.
And presumably, if people are interested in following through with this, they go to the ebay.co.uk website /eBay for change. Is that the best place to go?
That is exactly it. And the hub is live today, and you'll find lots and lots of great businesses out there having a huge impact on the world.
And as a relative newcomer to eBay, in fact, I just made my first purchase last year or so. No, it was a long time since I actually sort of engaged with the whole process. I'm just interested to find out, Chris, can you remember your first ever purchase on eBay?
That is a good question, Alex. And I think I've only been at eBay 12 months. I think I got asked in 12 months ago as well, and I couldn't remember then. I've been an eBay member since I was about probably 20 years, I think. And I honestly can't remember what it would be.
Well, mine was a set of
PlayStation game, I imagine.
I see. I think mine was a set of coasters featuring the Star Trek television series, but that's by the by. It's another line entirely. For the moment, though, huge thanks for contributing to today. A reminder, of course, you can go to the eBay website and find out about how you can follow through with respect to the eBay for Change program. But for now, as mentioned, Chris Gale, head of social research or social impact, I should say, at eBay UK. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and be happy.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, allowing for the fact that the adoption of technology has always been at the heart of what makes innovative and productive businesses, it's perhaps a little disappointing to find that a recent survey suggests that the United Kingdom is falling a little bit short when it comes to competing economies because of the challenges associated with introducing it. Certainly those of us who have actually had to get used to the joys of Microsoft Teams and Collaborate Ultra and various other sort of joys of the educational sort of field in higher education will probably echo the sort of stresses and strains that are actually endemic in that. But to talk us through the vital importance of technology and business, we're delighted to welcome two fantastic individuals. First of all, the Chief Executive Officer from Be The Business. That's the wonderful Anthony Impey, MBE. How are you, Anthony?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. How are you, Alex? And indeed, the Digital Skills Lead from the Open University. That's the fabulous Jane Dickinson. How are you, Jane?
Very well, thank you, Alex.
Jane, if we can turn to you first, because I mentioned obviously the challenges that we at the University of Lincoln have actually faced in terms of obviously delivering material online, et cetera, and that's right across the base, et cetera. Were you surprised by the kind of findings that actually, in terms of the nation of Britain, we're not necessarily doing as well as we could be doing in terms of people's awareness and facility with using technology?
Well, I think there are a number of challenges which probably make that a little bit less surprising, Alex, and not least the pace of change, because there's a phrase I really like, which is, you know, the pace of change has never been so fast and it will never be as slow again. So we're almost in this, you know, continual struggle to kind of keep up with technology and make sure that we do have all of the skills to be able to adopt it successfully. So certainly what we found in the report was that, you know, small and medium-sized businesses have really accelerated their adoption of technology since the start of the pandemic. So that's really good news. But there is some way to go. You know, only half of business leaders think that they make good decisions when it comes to purchasing it. And also over three quarters felt that they didn't have the required technical skills to be able to adopt and implement it successfully. And when we look at the reasons for that, time and cost are the biggest barriers to both tech adoption and also investment in skills. So I think that's probably where we need to put a bit of focus going forwards.
Anthony, from the point of view of businesses adopting new technologies, I mean, clearly a lot of businesses have done that, but there is this still notion of reluctance to do that. I mean, what has your findings been, or what's your sense, shall we say, of how small, medium enterprises have been effectively connecting with new technology? Has it been generally good, or perhaps could do better?
Well, I mean, I think if anything's taught us over the last 12 months about the importance of technology, it's how technology has essentially enabled so many small businesses to survive and in many instances thrive during the pandemic. You know, in our own research, we found that In just 3 months, there was 3 years worth of innovation that small businesses had incorporated as a result of the pressures of the pandemic. So, you know, I think there's some really, really positive signs that actually small businesses are getting behind technology and they are beginning to recognize the importance of it within their organizations. But as this research shows, you know, there is still a lot more to do. And, you know, one of the big barriers is around skills and helping small businesses develop the skills they need, both within their teams themselves, but also amongst the leaders of those businesses. And certainly from my own experience, and I've spent my career starting and scaling small businesses, you know, it is always making sure that the leadership team, the people that are leading the organization, have the skills they need in order to introduce digital into their organization so that it has this huge impact. And so that more and more businesses can start using technology as a lever to drive their growth, improve their resilience, and drive their underlying productivity.
Jane, there's always a big difference between the philosophical notions of training and education, and we really don't have time to actually start debating the pedagogical values of both. But if we're looking at the training aspect, is it fair to say that there are so many online systems via the big giants like YouTube or 5-minute videos, Microsoft, of course, etc., that actually universities also have to play catch up in terms of how we do our training and how indeed digital skills are actually learnt and developed so that they are usable? Because I've been, as I'm sure you will have been, on many training courses where you thought, well, I've actually learnt more in a 5-minute session that I've almost taught myself than actually for this 3-hour session that we've all had to be part of.
Yeah, so I mean, people learn in different ways. And of course, you know, the size of the skills gap can vary, you know, really quite massively. So we do really need in the training ecosystem a whole range of different interventions, if you want to call it that. Let's call them courses, little chunks of bite-sized learning, all the way up to larger programs, which help people develop skills and do that in a way that works for them. So, you know, here at the Open University, we find that one of the most useful and helpful things that we do revolves around our approach to learning. So it's highly flexible. It flexes around someone's work and family commitments so that they can engage with it and they can move forwards with that new learning. And I think that's really important, because if we think about this in the context of the pace of change of technology, all of us are going to need to be continually learning all of the time, and that needs to just become a way of life for us. So having something that's accessible, and you know, whether that be bite-sized, of course, or whether it be a little bit longer, it's really important that people have access to those opportunities irrespective of where they live, so that they can move with those times, and it really supports them as they move forwards in their careers.
And Anthony, from your own perception of the future, which many people would say that we're living it at present, really, in many ways, etc., do you feel as though, given that there's 168 hours in a week, we'll be fully connected for every second of those 168 hours, that we'll have to sort of balance our digital detoxing with our upgrades, with our training packages and so on? And is it essentially an optimistic view that we've actually got, or is Britain going to, again, somehow lag behind?
Well, you know, we start from a point where within the UK, it takes a British worker 5 days to do what a French, German or American worker does within 4 days. So we've got some catching up to do. Now, while that might seem a bit of a grim outlook, the good news is that we have some of the world's most productive businesses within the country. And so we've got great examples of really, really good practice that lots of other businesses can learn from. And so I think the challenge is, how do we share that best practice across the business community so that businesses across the country can become more productive? So I think that's the, you know, actually I'm very optimistic about the opportunity to do that. I think we're starting from a point where there's definitely room for improvement, but I think there is a source of great optimism. And I think, you know, that optimism comes from how small businesses have reacted to the pandemic and how so many businesses have changed direction, pivoted their business models, started selling to new customers and new markets that they hadn't previously worked in. And because of that agility and that flexibility and that entrepreneurial spirit that is at the core of so many small businesses in the country, I think there is a great source of optimism. And just to, you know, your final point around, you know, does this mean that we're going to be switched on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? You know, I think ultimately, you know, customers decide that. And I think customers' expectations are increasingly high. And I think there is a challenge for all businesses, how they respond to these ever-increasing demands of consumers. And you know, it's consumers, whether it's, you know, consumers shopping on the high street, or maybe, you know, consumers that are, you know, buying business services. I think there is a higher expectation. And I think one of the big challenges that small businesses face is how do they move towards this 24-hour economy that we are heading towards. And the great news is that technology is a neighbor of that, is that actually if you put the technology in place, it can do so much of the heavy lifting that that requires. So yes, I think, you know, it's an uncertain future that we're heading towards. It's a future, as James describes, a future of rapid change. But I think there is tremendous opportunity. And yes, I'm very optimistic for the future.
Not so much the case of mind the gap, but closing the UK's productivity gap, to go back to the original inception of Be the Business and the way in which that's developed. Jane, final thoughts from yourself in terms of, we head into a world where artificial intelligence is consistently being flagged up as another way forward. We already find in the field of journalism that a lot of data journalism is actually produced by AI programs and so on and so forth. Is that something else we need to be concerned about? Is that a case of, again, SMEs will say, well, ultimately, just as Anthony suggested, the technology's there, it makes it easier for us, it can actually sort of just run it on our behalf. Is that one of the ways in which the OU ultimately will be functioned on the basis of, we'll simply have a completely virtual university?
Well, maybe, Alex. And I think it's something absolutely we need to be aware of. And I think that, you know, we're already seeing technologies like AI start to complement the work that we do. And I think, you know, in the near future, we will see that technology starts to be able to take away from us perhaps some of the more mundane tasks that we all have in our day-to-day jobs, freeing us up to work on other aspects. And, you know, for us, as we move forwards in this new digital world, we're all going to need some digital skills for us to be able to work with the technology, but also think about those essential skills that make us human that are also going to be really helpful to us. So things like communication and the problem solving. So I think it's really important to invest in those to help businesses thrive, and also to give the workforce the confidence to be able to adapt as things change.
BeTheBusiness.com being one web link to go to. Similarly, open.ac.uk will take you to the Open University. Final question for yourself, Anthony. Any short words of wisdom or advice that you might have for small, medium enterprises or SMEs who are looking to update and indeed introduce new technology? Would it be a case of don't be afraid, just go for it?
Absolutely. I mean, technology can provide so much benefits to small businesses. It can really turbocharge, in fact, a small business's performance. So I think it is very much a case of not being afraid. Look for the skills that help integrate technology into the business. Think about how it can fit into the strategy of the business and how it can help improve the quality of service to customers, and especially make it easier for customers to do business with you. And I think if you approach it from that perspective, you know, it will deliver huge benefits to the organization that you run.
Anthony Impey, Chief Executive Officer for Be The Business, and Jane Dickinson, Digital Skills Lead for the Open University. Huge thanks, and continue your digital happinesses, people.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, we're at that midterm break, and clearly there are going to be a lot of families being reunited after months of being denied face-to-face contact. Indeed, with many grandparents able to finally make the trip to visit their children, there's going to be an estimated reunification of all wonderful aspects within this whole field, with 71% of the nation's grandparents excitedly counting down the days until they see their grandchildren. To talk us around the sort of psychological elements of this, and indeed ways in which this megabus survey has actually sort of outlined a whole range of things, we're delighted to welcome child psychologist extraordinaire, it's Sam Wass. How are you, Sam?
Hi, Alex. I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Now, I'm speaking to somebody who sadly never knew my grandparents on either side, but from your own perspective, how important is that relationship between grandchildren and grandparents?
Yeah, so it's very sad. So my granddad also died before I was born, and it always makes me sad when I think about this, Alex. I mean, there is a lot of research now suggesting that children benefit a lot from their relationships with their grandparents. But the really big change has been how much research has come out recently suggesting just how important it is for grandparents to be interacting with their children. So this is one of the things that I think there's going to be a lot more research coming out over the next couple of years. So we already, over the past 5-10 years, have had a lot of research on the effects of loneliness, not just on mental health outcomes, things like anxiety and depression. You know, you worry about stuff, but if you've got other people around, you just worry about it less, but also on physical health outcomes. So, you know, how aware you are, everyone starts to get aches and pains as they get older. And again, the research suggests you just become less aware of them when you have things to take your mind off it, like kids running around, but also on really, really, you know, most hardcore physical health outcomes, things like life expectancy. So more loneliness is associated with lower life expectancy. So as I say, there's going to be a lot more coming out about the effect of this, these types of things during the course of lockdown, how this has affected us. But now the really, really kind of strong recommendation is now that these recommendations are starting to relax, we get back to be able to travel and see our family and to have physical contact with our family, this is definitely something that's really, really important to get going on, because it's really, really important for our physical and mental health.
Quite intrigued to find how it was quantified that on average, most families have missed out on an average of 49 hugs, 47 kisses and 40 conversations in the last year.
I know, it's a lovely, beautifully precise figures. And 18 school pickups, 27 playtimes with toys, 24 story times, and exactly 19 bedtimes. This is this survey from Megabus that got grandparents to estimate how many of these things they've missed out on during lockdown.
So how important will these grand reunions actually be? Because there's always that tendency that we almost over amplify the expectations, and those expectations are so high that actually when it actually happens, I don't know, was that it? Do we need to actually give a balance to our approaches here?
No, I think that's sensible, Alex, but the thing is, it depends how, I think from my experience of having talked to lots of families about this, the people's attitudes to it varies a lot depending on how much screen contact they've had during the past year. So some grandparents have, you know, jumped and really taught themselves how to use screens, and others just haven't been able to make that jump. So for quite a lot of families, they really haven't seen or talked to their grandparents much over the course of the past year, whereas other families have been in contact a lot, just it's all been via screen. And I think particularly for the former type of family, where there really hasn't been much contact at all, there is natural for there to be some apprehension, you know, both on the part of the grandparent and on the course of on the side of the grandchild. But so there's definitely things that we can do to manage that. You know, things like getting some toys on hand for you to play with. Everybody's more relaxed if there are kind of concrete things to play with. Maybe for grandparents, putting a bit of time into childproofing your house. You know, it doesn't take long to tie together any cupboards that have got any valuables in with tights. That's what we do in my family. We just go around and put these tights over the cupboard doors, and then everybody's more relaxed. But also, I think the really important thing to be aware of about these reunions is physical contact is relaxing. So that's one of the really, really important things that we've been missing. It's been a very anxiety-filled year for everybody, for grandparents and for grandkids. And there is so much research out there suggesting that simple physical contact, one person touching another, sets off this cascade of chemicals through our body, which makes us feel much more relaxed. So, you know, one of the things is when you get into that hug, you know, almost all of the time, you know, the tension starts to release just simply from that moment where you have that first physical contact.
So share with us the grand reunion ticket, which, of course, Megabus are actually putting together, and in terms of how people can actually find out information about the fantastic grand reunion ticket.
Yeah, so this is something that Megabus has launched to help to support grandparents travelling to their grandchildren. Nice bit of factor that the average grandparent spends 89 hours, 52 minutes a year travelling to see their grandchildren. Amounting to a cost of £240. So another wonderfully precise figure there for you, Alex. So Megabus have been trying to help grandparents through this because it's a really, really important thing that obviously the cost of it is really tough to bear for a lot of families. So they've launched this grand reunion competition. So anyone can enter it if they're a grandparent, no matter what age you are. And then they randomly select 10 to win free travel on the Megabus network to visit their grandkids or indeed to go anywhere else they want to for a year. So really, really nice competition. Obviously, as well, Megabus is trying to raise awareness of the fact that they are very cost efficient way of making these long journeys that grandparents do. You know, it's a very intimate kind of, it's a very kind of much more familiar form of transport. There are not so many people on the bus, so you can much more have a chat with the bus driver. No confusing connections to make at different train stations, that type of thing. So a very convenient way to get around. So really, really nice to see Megabus supporting this. You know, from my point of view, I'm a scientist, and I think this is really, really important campaign to support. You know, just because of this evidence that I've been telling you about, Alex, just about the physical and mental health benefits of grandparents from seeing their kids. So really, really important thing to be promoting, I think, Alex. If you want to find out more, you can just Google Megabus Grand Reunion, and then it comes straight up.
Couldn't be simpler. Absolutely wonderful, and delighted to touch base with yourself, Sam Walsh, child psychologist extraordinaire. Keep on keeping on, and enjoy Megabus travel.
Oh, thank you very much. I will do.